You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear from a professor who's using baseball to help people suffering from dementia. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. The EPA weighs in on smog regulations for southeast Wisconsin areas. Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin is taking the lead in a federal lawsuit challenging changes to the federal Title X law that could affect access to contraceptives. And GOP Senate candidate Kevin Nicholson made some controversial comments about veterans who support Democrats. Robert Mentzer is with us. He's a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks.
Let's start with the EPA. This announcement came out on Tuesday. They're significantly reducing the areas in southeastern Wisconsin that need to address high smog levels. Who wins in this change, Rob?
Yeah, so this really comes back to Foxconn, because I think everything must come back to Foxconn. But it takes a minute to get there. But basically, yeah, the EPA has all these standards for clean air, regulations of ozone in the air, also known as smog. So Wisconsin made an argument. Governor Scott Walker made this argument, and it's sort of the favored argument of business interests, that there's a bunch of smog that comes into the air from Chicago and, like, industrial northwestern Indiana that ends up floating in the air over Wisconsin, and so therefore it is unfair to penalize these areas of Wisconsin when it's really Illinois and Indiana's fault that they may, you know, if you measure and you may have, you know, high smog levels, which, okay. So what the outcome of this change is that Racine County is no longer included by the EPA, is no longer included in the area that needs to worry at all about tougher air quality regulations. And Racine County is where Foxconn is going to go. So what this means is that there are certain rules that won't apply to the new Foxconn facility, like some pollution control technology they might otherwise have to put into that factory.
Right. So if I wanted to build a factory in the zone including these tougher restrictions, and there are still some of these areas in southeast Wisconsin, it's just a smaller area than previously considered. If I want to build in that zone, I might need more and more expensive pollution controls. If I'm not, as Foxconn is not, I don't need those things.
Right, exactly right, exactly right. And, you know, another option for companies within the zone is, like, to buy offsets from other manufacturers and so on. But the point is, it's like additional expenses. That's why the business lobbying groups are against this. Possibly of interest, there was reporting in the Chicago Tribune that said that this decision came directly from EPA head Scott Pruitt, and that he had overruled career staff within the Environmental Protection Agency to do so. In fact, they say, the Chicago Tribune reports, that he actually took counties from Illinois and from Indiana off the EPA's regulation list as well, which, if you were to take it at face value, it seems like the opposite of what you do if you agreed with the argument from Governor Scott Walker.
And what are environmental groups saying about this decision?
Well, I mean, smog is bad. The ozone in the air it creates real health problems. Asthma or other sort of heart diseases. There is real reason why, besides just it sort of being disgusting in a, you know, very industrial smoggy area. There are real effects on people's health in these areas. So they're, you know, the environmental groups are saying that this is going to harm air quality in southeastern Wisconsin, that the public would be better off if there were more of these regulations in place.
I want to switch over to another kind of complicated federal regulation story that affects Wisconsin. Rob, Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin.
I love a complicated federal regulation story.
Who doesn't?
Yeah, come on.
Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin and counterparts in other states filed a lawsuit this week against the Trump administration over changes to the federal Title X program. So what is this? What is this Title X? Why are they challenging it?
Right. So Title X is, I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but Title X is what allows Planned Parenthood to exist as a provider of healthcare to low-income women. Which just to say right up front that this is a debate about contraception. It is not directly to do with abortion. That's what everyone sort of jumps to and wants to debate about. But that's really not what this is about. Planned Parenthood runs a couple of abortion clinics in Wisconsin, but it also runs something like 19 clinics that provide health services, contraception, pap smears, STD testing for women. And the reason that they can do that is this thing, Title X, that allows federal funding for those services. This is a 50-year-old program. And so the change under the Trump administration is that that pot of money could now go to organizations that don't offer information about contraceptions or don't offer STD testing, but instead talk about abstinence education or talk about the rhythm method as a contraception technique. And the argument in the lawsuit is that stretches the definition of the of what the law, of what this funding is for, to the breaking point, to the point that it is actually a violation of the law.
So this suit just filed. Any idea when this hits the courts and will start being argued?
So these things just always take forever. There are, the Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin, their grant had been set to expire at the end of March. That's now been extended through August. So to the extent that's the time in which we really be talking about dollars and cents, I think that they'll make an argument that it should be resolved by then. But who knows? These legal cases can drag on, you know.
Talking to Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network Wisconsin, rounding up some top stories in Wisconsin news. Turning to the Republican race, the primary race to face off against Senator Tammy Baldwin. Going to listen to both the candidates, Republican candidates here. State Senator Leah Vukmir and businessman and former Marine Kevin Nicholson clashed this week over the role of military experience in politics. Here's Vukmir talking to station WTMJ.
Just like it is for veterans all across the state, Republican, Democrat, Independent, their service is honorable. But it's not the same as my conservative track record. And if you look at Senator Kerry, Senator McCain, both served this country honorably. And I respect that service. We as Americans are indebted to that service. But that doesn't mean that I, as a proven conservative, can't and don't take issue with many of their policy stances.
And Kevin Nicholson responded on the same station, WTMJ, on Wednesday.
Just because some people that don't call themselves conservatives and don't always act conservative do something conservative, like let's talk about John Kerry and signed up to serve his country, that doesn't mean that's not a conservative thing to fundamentally protect and defend the Constitution. Because I'll tell you, the Democrat Party has wholesale rejected the Constitution and the values that it was founded upon. So I'll tell you what, those veterans that are out there in the Democrat Party, I question their cognitive thought process, because the bottom line is they're signing up to defend a Constitution that their party is continually dragging through the mud.
So that question, the cognitive thought process of veterans of the Democratic Party, that got some response, Rob. Can you talk about that?
Right. I mean, you can hear it right there. But what Leah Vukmir was doing was sort of the boilerplate, sort of accepted way that politicians speak about military service, which is as an honorable thing to do, and quite separate from normal political tribalism. Nicholson, who of course is himself a U.S. Marine veteran, decided to not honor that, or not, at least question that distinction. And if you follow what the case that he's making, he's questioning whether a veteran should ever, hold a politically liberal view or be a Democrat, and that is that goes beyond a sort of a political norm, and it definitely got a big reaction in the media and so on. But I guess we go beyond political norms these days. This may be an innovation on his part.
We'll be watching this race. A lot of months to go still there until the August primaries. Rob, I want to turn to an issue that maybe unites more people in Wisconsin across the political spectrum. Frozen custard. We touched on this briefly yesterday. New flavors on the horizon from one of our custard chains, a big one, Culver's.
Oh, yes. This is so important. I am so proud to say that I want to say USA Today Network, Wisconsin's own Dan Higgins had the exclusive.
He got the scoop?
This month. Yes, so to speak. So new flavors of the day. This is a big thing for Culver's. They've got a flavor of the day rotation. You drive past the Culver's and you see it on the sign. You think, oh, maybe I do want to go in and get some custard after all. So they're over the next 6 months, they're going to be rolling out such flavors as cappuccino cookie crumble and blackberry cobbler and dark chocolate decadence. And Rob, it's going to be amazing.
I'm looking forward. I have been known to pull off the road to try the particular flavor. Rob, you do too, probably. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Robert Mentzer, statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Alzheimer's disease currently affects 5.7 million people in the United States. Researchers aren't sure of the cause and have yet to find a cure. Our next guest is taking a unique approach to improving the quality of life for people dealing with Alzheimer's using baseball memories.
There's a long drive way back in center field, way back, back, it is ball! Running just brought this crowd to its feet with a catch, which must have been an optical illusion to a lot of people.
The famous Willie Mays over-the-shoulder catch there. Michael Ego is a professor of human development and family studies at the University of Connecticut. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Before we get into the work you're doing, you've written that there's a lot of effort going into trying to find cures for Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia, and that's important. You want to see more work done on improving the quality of life for people who actually have Alzheimer's. Can you talk about why you see that as being so important?
Well, I see it as important because, as you just mentioned, there's no cure, and actually there's also no definitive cause that we can point to. And so the people that have the disease, as you know, there's various stages, which varies from early stage to late stage. And at each stage, people lose, or as a stage gets later, that they lose more of their cognitive function and memory. And so what I'm more concerned about is what can we do to help these individuals who suffer from this disease have a good time. And when I say have a good time, in a way that is related to something that they're familiar with. And with a lot of these individuals, baseball has been part of their lives for many years. And so we would like to trigger their memories and have some enjoyment in talking about baseball.
I know there's been work, and you write about this too, doing things like acting, drama, poetry, other forms of creativity. There's a lot of work actually going on in Wisconsin on this. What led you on the path toward talking about sports with people with Alzheimer's?
Well, the thing was is that I first discovered this program as it pertains to baseball in St. Louis, and the St. Louis Cardinals baseball team collaborated with the VA Hospital and the Alzheimer's Association in St. Louis to start a program in baseball. The person that started that program got the idea from Scotland, where in Scotland they initiated a program that was focused on sports reminiscence, which had not been done before, and more specifically to address the men or the males that were not perceived to be having enough socialization programs as compared to the females in Scotland. And so I actually have had the opportunity to travel to Scotland on two occasions where I've actually observed what's going on in Scotland, and they're doing a phenomenal situation with what they're doing for their for the people that have the disease.
Talk about how this works in practice, whether it's the program on soccer in Scotland or what you're doing with Alzheimer's patients, talking about baseball. What actually happens?
Well, it's essentially an opportunity to talk about baseball from their past. And this could be as if they have been participants where they played baseball when they were younger. and also as spectators and fans of baseball. And this could be local baseball, it could be college baseball, it could be regional baseball, and in our case, it's mostly importantly for the Major League Baseball in the New York area, where over time we've had the Brooklyn Dodgers, who went to Los Angeles, and the New York Giants, who went to San Francisco. And, of course, right now we have the New York Mets and the New York Yankees, who've been here for quite a while. And so we sort of, I would say, tend to talk about the Major League teams, but we also talk about some of the local teams that also were part of their lives early on.
So you're talking about baseball. Do you watch baseball historical highlights or current games as well?
Yes, we do a combination of things. Matter of fact, we just had a session yesterday, and we had a session on baseball jokes. And so what we did was we had each of the participants, you know, give a handout, and and each person was asked to read a particular joke. Okay, example, one of the jokes was, why was Cinderella such a bad baseball player? Answer, because the pumpkin was a coach. Okay, so those kinds of, you know, fun kinds of stuff that we do. And so yesterday, the participants, we asked a joke, and then we said, okay, who knows the answer? And, you know, some people know the answer, some people don't. And then we laugh and we have a good time. But it triggers memories about baseball in general, and that's what we're trying to focus on, is to give them a chance to have a good time with their peers, which is another important thing, because, you know, we're talking about people that have the same disease, and they gather around this table with volunteers who are also a very important part of this program, and we try to provide a good time, because, again, for most of their time, they suffer.
Talking to Michael Ego, professor of human development and family studies at the University of Connecticut, talking about a program, a project he's working on, using baseball memories to work with people with Alzheimer's, to improve their quality of life. So, Michael, there's the baseball jokes, there's watching, there's talking about baseball. How do you see individuals react? What happens as they're doing this?
Oh, number one, I mean, we do this every 2 weeks for 1 hour. 1 hour every 2 weeks, so it's not a regular programming where it's like every day. And so these participants, they walk into the room, and you can see the smile on their faces because they know that they're going to have an opportunity to socialize with others. And again, it's not the cure, and you know, it'd be great if they could find the cure, because again, this disease is so awful. But if we can give them a chance to reminisce about something that they've enjoyed all their lives, in this case baseball, that we feel that this particular activity does enhance, even for a little while, the quality of life.
I want to talk about that social connection angle, because it seems like there's a double tragedy here. You have Alzheimer's, which is bad in and of itself, but that can be very isolating. It makes it hard to talk to people, makes it hard for people to talk to you in some ways, and we know that social connection is really important, even for completely healthy people. How important is it to get to that social connection in there for people with Alzheimer's?
Well, the one thing that we are somewhat fortunate about is that this particular program that we offer is done at an adult daycare center, which, you know, is a daily program. It's not an institutional facility where the individuals come on a daily basis. They live at home and care for by caregivers. And so the chance that they have is actually enhanced because of that, because they're not, you know, again, they're not in institutionalized facilities where sometimes it is very difficult for them. And so we are able to connect the dots with the facility itself, because the facility also does provide services that also make their lives enjoyable as well.
I know you're still, this is an ongoing project, you're still working on your research, but are there maybe lessons out there for people who either have relatives who have Alzheimer's or work with people with Alzheimer's to try to find something that gave the person joy in the past and give opportunities to encounter that, even if it's not detailed conversations about their memories, just expose them to that thing, whether it's baseball or music or whatever, that brought them joy in the past, and see if it still does now.
Right. Well, as you mentioned at the beginning of the program, you know, there has been evidence that creative arts programs, that there's evidence that does make a difference in improving the quality of life for individuals. It's just that you know, sports has been more of a recent kind of introduction to an intervention that we can use to make people's lives better. And so, yes, I think anything that someone enjoys or has enjoyed in the past, okay, you know what it is? My feeling is that there is a stigma attached to this disease and that people are fearful because they're misinformed. And, for instance, I've had people say to me, oh, I don't want to be around these individuals because I don't want to catch what they have. And I said, what do you mean catch? It's not contagious. And they go, it's not? I said, no. And so, you know, those kinds of things are really, really bothersome to me. Like, how can they, how would they even think that way? And so I hope that the other message that I would like to send out to the listeners is that we need to show more compassion by understanding the realities of this disease, and that is, it's not contagious, it's not automatic once you get to a certain age, and that you can be engaged in interaction with these individuals and be able to enhance their lives and show your compassion for them.
It's a good place to leave it. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Michael Ego, professor of human development and family studies at the University of Connecticut. We've been talking about his work with Alzheimer's patients with conversations about baseball. The state of American manufacturing was a big part of the last presidential campaign. Here's then-candidate Donald Trump at a campaign rally in Florida 2 years ago.
We're going to renegotiate NAFTA, probably the worst trade deal ever agreed to, signed, in the history of the world, not in the United States. It's destroyed our manufacturing in our country.
For Trump, the problem was trade deals and China. But there's another argument. Some economists say the real reason we lost manufacturing jobs was because of automation. But our next guest says the president was on the right track. Gwynne Gilford is a reporter for Quartz who covers the global economy. She's with us now to talk about her recent piece for Quartz, The Epic Mistake About Manufacturing That's Cost Americans Millions of Jobs. Gwynne, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's great to be here.
Well, I want to break this kind of a complicated story. I want to break it down one step at a time. First, one thing I think everybody agrees on, we have lost manufacturing jobs in the United States. Can you talk about the scale and scope of that?
Yeah, so basically, manufacturing jobs had been relatively stable for a while in the 80s and 90s, and then all of a sudden you hit 2000 and they start, they plummet. And they lost, the manufacturing sector lost around 6 million jobs between 2000 and 2010, and that's recovered a little bit, but we're nowhere near close to where we were in, even before the Great Recession, 2006. Let alone where we were in 2000. It's still close to, it's about close to 5 million jobs that have been lost.
Now, a lot of people, in some ways, the conventional wisdom was this is outsourcing, this is jobs moving overseas. But there was this argument, well, it's automation. And looking at some of the numbers, some of the measures of production and manufacturing, even as we're losing jobs, it looks like we're producing a lot of stuff. We're producing a lot of value worth of stuff. So that must mean it's automation. Fewer workers are producing more stuff. But you write that actually there's a problem in how we measure that value of the stuff we produce that really skews the picture. Can you explain that to us?
Right. So when economists are trying to figure out how a sector is doing, they need to compare how much volume you're producing this year versus the last year versus the year before that. And, you know, there are things that can distort that, like price. So when prices go up, you know, because of inflation or something, it could be that you sold a lot more, or it could just be that the prices went up. So they control for that. And another thing, like, that's pretty straightforward, and you do that with everything to get the real versus nominal output amount, right? So, but the weirder one is the quality adjustment. And This is done when you have dramatic increases in the quality of a product. So, for instance, you know, this is a very hypothetical example because, you know, we don't make iPhones in the U.S. They're made in China. Everybody knows that. But let's just say, let's take a thing everyone's familiar with, the iPhone. Okay, so from one year to the next, iPhones, you know, increase in, you know, their photo quality, their memory, their speed, all these performance aspects, and people will pay more for them. You know, right now you can buy an iPhone 8, 7, and 6 on the, if you go into an Apple store, and, you know, the prices are, you know, quite different. So what the statisticians need to do is, like, they recognize that an iPhone 8 is not really comparable to an iPhone 6 because you're getting, the consumers are getting so much more value out of an 8 because it can do so much more. So to make them comparable, they need to adjust for that quality difference the same way you would do with prices. But what they do is they look at the difference in prices between the, you know, say this year's model and one from last year, and say, okay, that reflects the value to consumers. And, you know, so if the iPhone 8, say, costs twice as much as the iPhone, you know, 7, then one iPhone 8 must be counted, they count it as equal to selling two iPhone 7s. So that could, when you have that quality adjustment applied to particularly this very small sector called the computers and electronics sector, where all of these products are increasing in quality really fast because technology is improving really quickly, what it does is it makes it either, you could interpret these huge leaps in output either as an increase in the sales volume, or it's, you know, that what it reflects is the statistician's assumption that people are valuing the iPhone or the processor or whatever product a lot more because of that superior performance.
And then your piece, you look at economists and others who have stripped out that computer and electronics sector you were just talking about. Take it out of the numbers, separate it. What does the rest of the manufacturing world look like when you don't include that that value increase adjustment?
Yeah, so when you take it out, it turns out that manufacturing hasn't been growing at nearly the pace that it seems to have been when you just look at the official top-line data. And it's actually very hard to strip that out because of some complicated methodological things. So it's not well known that there is this quality adjustment that is sort of distorting the output data. But basically, it makes it look like manufacturing is doing a lot better than it is, and really, like, it hasn't been growing at nearly the pace of the private sector, of the rest of the private sector.
So the conclusion then you're making is, and that others are making, is that this shows, when you do this, it shows automation isn't really driving job loss. It is more job loss to countries overseas.
That's right. So, yeah, there's no research that has demonstrated that investment in IT and machines and robots and stuff like that has coincided with the job loss. Like, yes, there is automation in manufacturing for sure, but it's not taking place. It hasn't taken place at it hasn't been taking place faster than other sectors, at least since the 2000s. So what happened in the 2000s? Well, 2001, China exceeds the WTO. That was a huge factor. Also, it's after the 1997 Asian financial crisis, and a lot of Asian countries start hoarding U.S. dollars. And that has the effect of making U.S. dollars more expensive and therefore U.S. exports more expensive. And so that is definitely a factor. And, you know, the trade agreement thing is a little bit more complicated, but yes, these have the evidence is starting to pile up that trade competition did definitely hurt U.S. manufacturing, and those effects have been, you know, lasting.
And how much of the story is what you just mentioned first there, China?
It's really hard to get to quantify the effects of this stuff because, you know, in part because the automation story has been so dominant, there hasn't been a ton of research into what exactly has caused the decline in U.S. manufacturing. So we don't know. But China was definitely a massive factor because, you know, in large part because China is huge. But also because, you know, it what happened in 2001 was that basically China did manipulate its currency. It set, you know, it made its currency artificially cheaper. And when it joined the WTO, multinationals, U.S. companies could then be confident that, you know, if it continued to do that, the U.S. wasn't going to slap tariffs on Chinese goods, so they could move to China and take advantage of, you know, the cheap labor, but also the cheap currency.
We're talking to Gwen Guilford, reporter for Quartz, about what's driving the loss of manufacturing jobs in the United States. She says when you look at the numbers, it's more a story of foreign competition than a story of automation taking workers out of their jobs. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you used to work in manufacturing? Have you seen your line, your factory move out of the country or the factory in your community? Did President Trump's statements about manufacturing and job loss ring true to you? What do we do about it? Call in and tell us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. We continue our conversation about what's behind the decline in American manufacturing. Gwen Guilford is with us, reporter for Quartz. She's been writing about this, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you in manufacturing? Are you in the profession or in the business in Wisconsin? Have you seen jobs lost in your community? What is the solution? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Gwen, let's talk about that issue of solutions. The president and his administration are announcing likely tariffs. A lot of them have been on hold lately. Are tariffs part of the answer to this problem?
So tariffs can be good when you're a developing nation. For instance, you know, they were really important for helping the U.S. develop when it first became a country. And, you know, lots of Asian countries have modeled themselves off that policy, their development policies off that. But, you know, the U.S. is obviously not a developing country, and ultimately what tariffs do is they tax consumers and other businesses in order to protect a certain industry. And, you know, that's a big trade-off. Is that really going to help nurture industry in the U.S.? No, not really, probably not. Like, there's plenty of capital that could be invested, plenty of entrepreneurs. Like, you know, we don't really need to protect U.S. Businesses from foreign competition so much as perhaps, you know, create new incentives for high-tech investments and things like that.
Let's go to our callers now. Martin is with us in Ripon. Martin, hi.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm sorry to rain on the parade here, but a lot of what's being said is not only wrong, but I think your guest ought to think about what she's really contributing to politically, where this scapegoating of foreign trade and foreign countries ends up. If you look at manufacturing jobs as a percentage of the U.S. workforce, it's been a steady decline ever since World War II. Look at the graph. It's steadily down. There's not a huge drop-off in 2000. Secondly, the value of U.S. manufacturing has never been higher. And you should see what's going on here, you know, in Fond du Lac County. Mercury Marine, record sales, doubled their employment. Alliance Laundry, same exact story, but they depend on global sales.
Martin, thanks a lot for the call. Gwen, looking at your charts, or the charts you shared in your story, the number of manufacturing jobs you were writing was holding pretty steady, actually, up until that changing point, even if it maybe wasn't rising as a percentage of jobs before that. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And Martin has a good point. A lot of people point this out. The share has been declining since the 40s, and the share of manufacturing as like a share of total employment. You know, something similar happened in agriculture, and people like to draw parallels to that. But what happened with agriculture, is that, you know, you saw jobs drop really fast as a share of overall employment, and then they flatten out. And that's not really what we've seen in manufacturing. Like, if they keep on going the way they're going, they're just going to hit zero. So, you know, the analogy doesn't really hold. And, you know, what's probably more informative is the absolute number of jobs lost. Now, the other thing is the value of U.S. manufacturing has never been higher. That's exactly the thing that I was talking about in my story, the way we measure that is it mischaracterizes what is actually happening because of the disproportionate influence of computers and electronics and the quality adjustment for the products they make. So, you know, the value of U.S. manufacturing actually has been higher. It's not growing at the rate it should be. And the other thing to consider here is that manufacturing is not like other sectors. It's not like services, say. It's, you know, it provides jobs that tend to be very steady and well-paid. And it also, like, R&D is a very essential, you know, has a very important relationship with factories. Like, you design something, you want to, like, produce it, and then there's, you know, interaction back and forth between the R&D facility and the factory while they figure out, you know, they tinker with the design. And so when you lose manufacturing, when you lose factories, you also lose that innovative capacity that comes from having R&D facilities. And that's a really important, you know, job creator, but also source of technological innovation that does give U.S. manufacturing or anywhere else a competitive edge. So that's something else that the U.S. has also lost out on. I'm not saying that, like, that trade with other countries is, I mean, trade with other countries is good. That's the problem. Like, free trade has gotten a bad name in all of this. And free trade is actually not the problem here. What we're talking about are mechanisms that prevent trade from being free, like not letting a currency adjust to, you know, the price it should be.
Let's spend our last couple minutes on that, Gwen. You said tariffs, generally speaking, not the answer to the problem here. I understand China has backed off in some ways from its currency manipulation. Are there things that the United States can do that would make a difference for manufacturing jobs?
Yeah, that's a great point. In the last 2 years, it really hasn't been an issue. In 2016, heck, it wasn't an issue. If anything, the renminbi has been losing value, and their government has been selling down their assets in order to try to prop up the value. So, but other countries are still doing this, and it doesn't mean that that couldn't change. So, for instance, Korea is a pretty notorious and consistent manipulator of currencies. It's also a manufacturing powerhouse and competes with the U.S. We just renegotiated a free trade deal with it and did not address the currency issue. And this doesn't have to be a combative thing. It just needs to be, you know, the U.S. dollar is the global reserve currency, and that gives other countries the opportunity to buy a whole bunch of it, you know, and, you know, defend, to prop up their own employment as a result. And, you know, if we could collectively decide not to do that anymore. That would probably be the best thing to do, but it could also be negotiated in bilateral deals.
And briefly, as we wrap up, if we keep on focusing on automation as the cause of manufacturing job losses, do you see that leading us into more trouble?
Yeah, it seems like we should probably confront the problem that communities and many people around the U.S. face in order to start, you know, making the economy structure more balanced and make it work for, you know, it sounds corny, but more people. And continuing to believe that U.S. factories are at the cutting edge because they've got all these robots is, like, actually not what's going on. And it deludes us into thinking that the U.S. is more competitive than it is in this very, very crucial sector. So, you know, in order to come up with the solutions, you first have to acknowledge the problems.
Gwen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Gwen Guilford, a reporter who covers the global economy for Quartz. We were talking about research that shows automation is not the main factor for the decline in American manufacturing. It's more international competition. Organic food is grown into a $50 billion industry, but some Wisconsin farmers say they no longer trust that all certified producers are meeting the industry's standards. Hope Kerwin has more on how questioning the organic label could impact the industry's future.
Crunching through spring snow, Harriet Behar heads toward the high tunnel on her farm. Similar to a greenhouse, the high tunnel has heavy translucent plastic that insulates Behar's organic spinach plants from the cold.
when we start getting, you know, 45, 50 degree days, this is just going to get huge. But you can see it's been picked all winter.
Bihar says she's harvested spinach 6 or 7 times over the winter, a pretty productive crop for her farm. But when it comes to competing with hydroponic operations, where spinach is grown indoors in nutrient-filled water, Bihar says it's hard for her to keep up.
It's kind of like food on steroids. You know, because they're in a controlled environment, they don't have, you know, wind or no sun. I mean, they're under lights. This is a big difference.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture allows hydroponic operations to be certified as organic. But farmers across the country have been debating for almost a decade whether these soilless farms really meet the standards for their industry. Bihar says the problem is that hydroponics doesn't improve soil quality or protect natural resources, things that traditional organic farmers are required to document in order to be certified. Because of these exceptions and increasing reports of fraud in the industry, Bihar says many producers feel the USDA organic label doesn't guarantee the same quality that it once did.
If we're certified organic and the other people are certified organic, there's no way to distinguish ourselves in the marketplace, and we think consumers care, so we're going to have this add-on label.
Called the Real Organic Project, Bihar says the new label is meant to be an extension of the USDA organic seal, guaranteeing that crops are grown in soil and livestock and dairy producers are following animal welfare standards. But traditional organic farmers aren't the only ones frustrated with the National Organic Program. Some hydroponic producers, like Brian Ernst in Ripon, say they also think the organic label has lost some of its integrity.
Indoor farm is really starting to adopt a post-organic philosophy.
Ernst says when he started Ernesti Farms 4 years ago, he wanted to be certified organic. Now, he feels like the industry is commercially driven, and he doesn't think indoor farms like his need the label to be successful.
Just because customers see the USDA organic, you know, little symbol on a clamshell, doesn't necessarily give the customer all the information they're looking for.
Some in the industry worry that if farmers continue to lose faith in the USDA seal, it could hurt the force that has made organic worth a premium. John Mesko is executive director of the Midwest Organic and Sustainable Education Service. He says the USDA does not promote organic food as being worth more than conventionally produced food.
The real value that gets added to the organic label has come from farmers, food producers and distributors, retailers, co-ops. All of those folks have been the ones promoting organic and the certified organic label as beneficial.
And Mesko says the community needs to remain united in order for organics to keep growing.
We have to proceed as a community with caution to make sure that we don't create so much confusion that we lose the momentum behind the broader organic movement.
But Harriet Bihar doesn't see the Real Organic Project's add-on label as a reason for division. In fact, she's hoping it will be a rallying cry for farmers across the country.
This might be a push to the National Organic Program to improve what they're already doing, to kind of show that the organic community wants to do this, and if they're not going to do it, we're going to do it on our own.
Bihar says consumers will start to see the new organic add-on label on products in 2019. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up Monday here on Central Time, we spend a lot of time in our own neighborhoods, but a guest makes the case that we need to go one step beyond and explore the world outside of our comfort zone. We'll visit a massive art and music festival in Milwaukee featuring the creative work of hundreds of high school students. And the author of The Truth About Animals joins the show to clear up misconceptions about sloths, eels, hippos, and more. This has changed what I think about sloths, I promise you. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.